Hello and greetings from Asheville, North Carolina. In case my voice is unfamiliar to you, I'm Dr. Han Lai, the founder and current spiritual director of Urban Dharma. Thanks to the wonders of technology, we have been able to share a good number of the programs we have offered the last 6 years in Asheville, and occasionally programs I have done elsewhere with this podcast. I hope you have found these programs educational, informative, and helpful to your own spiritual journey. I want to also take this opportunity to make a personal appeal to you to help us to continue to do what we have been doing here. Urban Dharma in North Carolina is entirely 100% volunteer-based. We do not have any employees, and I am neither on the payroll of Urban Dharma, nor do I accept any offerings from the community. Our operating costs are as slim as it can be, but nonetheless, we still need your support and help. So, would you consider either a one-time donation, or better yet, become one of our sustaining members who give on a regular basis so that we can continue to give the gift of Dharma to any and all who need it? If you are ready to help today, please drop us a line at benefactors@udharmanc.com. Again, benefactors@udharmanc.com. Or visit our giving page on our website, www.udharmanc.com. Again, www.udharmanc.com. But if you're not in a position to make a donation today, you can still help us by simply telling someone else about this podcast. Help us reach more people so that we can share the Dharma even more widely than we are currently doing. And finally, thank you, and please enjoy the following teaching brought to you by Urban Dharma, North Carolina.
Hello, and welcome to the Urban Dharma NC podcast. This is part one of a series about karma, the Buddha's compassionate explanation of reality, that our thoughts and actions determine our future. Dorje Lopa and Dr. Han Lai will help us unpack this important concept and show how the Buddha's teachings on karma can help us live good and happy lives for ourselves and others, despite a feeling of living in difficult times.
Let us begin by doing the recitations from recitations book. If you go to the first page of recitations book, the first and the second page, the altruistic motivation, both in terms of aspiration with that here.
Page one in the yellow book. All mother sentient beings, boundless as the sky, especially those enemies who hate me, obstructors who harm me, and those who create obstacles on my path to liberation and omniscience, may they experience happiness and be separated from suffering. I will quickly establish them in the state of the most perfect and precious Buddhahood. All mother sentient beings, boundless as the sky, especially those enemies who hate me, obstructors who harm me, and those who create obstacles on my path to liberation and omniscience. May they experience happiness and be separated from suffering. I will quickly establish them in the state of the most perfect and precious Buddhahood. All mother sentient beings, boundless as the sky, especially those enemies who hate me, obstructors who harm me, and those who create obstacles on my path to liberation and omniscience, may they experience happiness and be separated from suffering. I will quickly establish them in the state of the most perfect and precious Buddhahood. Thus, until I achieve enlightenment, I perform virtuous deeds with body, speech, and mind. Until death, I perform virtuous deeds with body, speech, and mind. From now until this time tomorrow, I perform virtuous deeds with body, speech, and mind.
to the top of page 6. In the Buddha,
Dharma, and Sangha most excellent, I take refuge until enlightenment is reached. By the merit of generosity and other perfections, may I attain Buddhahood for the sake of all sentient beings. In the Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha most excellent, I take refuge until enlightenment is reached. By the merit of generosity and other perfections, may I attain Buddhahood for the sake of all sentient beings. In the Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha most excellent, I take refuge until enlightenment is reached. By the merit of generosity and other perfections, may I attain Buddhahood for the sake of all sentient beings.
May all
other sentient beings, boundless as the sky, have happiness and the causes of happiness. May they be liberated from suffering and the causes of suffering. May they never be separated from the happiness that is free from sorrow. May they rest in equanimity, free from attachment and aversion.
May all
mother sentient beings, boundless as the sky, have happiness and the causes of happiness. May they be liberated from suffering and the causes of suffering. May they never be separated from the happiness that is free from sorrow. May they rest in equanimity, free from attachment and aversion.
May
all mother sentient beings, boundless as the sky, have happiness and the causes of happiness. May they be liberated from suffering and the causes of suffering. May they never be separated from the happiness that is free from sorrow. May they rest in equanimity, free from attachment and aversion.
Collect the text. Good afternoon, and welcome to Urban Dharma. If this is your first time here, some important things include there is a toilet back there in the back kitchen space on the left. Then there is also a kettle back there where you can make hot water, and there is a bunch of tea bags and all of that. Please help yourself to the tea. We do ask that when you're done with your mugs, that if you could clean that out and put it where you found it. I am responsible for the somewhat obnoxious sign in the kitchen by the sink that says, "Please don't make yourself at home." When I used to teach college and have more interaction with young people, very idealistic in a good way, young people, very concerned about the state of the world that we are in. I cannot imagine how they're feeling right now. I used to tease them that there should be a sign in the common shared kitchen of their living space that says, kind of like a bumper sticker, except that it's for the sink and not for the bumper, that says, "You can't save the world if you can't do your dishes." And as we will see, hopefully, in this series on karma, that in fact, one of the key points that the Buddha is making in teaching about karma, one of the take-home lessons that we should get from this teaching on karma, this whole, actually rather complex, big ideas on karma, is that of the significance and the importance of seemingly small and sometimes seemingly insignificant actions that we all do. And also the emphasis on personal nature of karma. Now, we're going to hear things like collective karma. So it's not exclusively personal, but the main thrust of it is personal. But that's not the whole picture. But one of the take-home lessons for karma is that of, I guess you could say, personal responsibility, except that, again, that phrase, right, seems to be at times really burdensome. It's personal responsibility, yes, but what that means is that it is possible for us to change the way in which we experience things, even when things seem to be this way or that way, seem to be firmly fixed this way or that way, it is still possible for a different experience to emerge in the face of whatever events, whatever conditions that are emerging, seemingly, or you could say maybe reasonably said to be going on out there. So that's one of the points. Yeah. But anyway, before so then a few words on how these three classes are going to be organized. In some ways, for these three classes, I am switching back to a little bit more of my college professor previous lifetime, kind of past life regression and channeling a little bit of that. So what we're going to do is to take a kind of somewhat historical survey of notions of karma. Yeah, so we will begin, in fact, with the pre-Buddhist use and notions of the word karma, and then the various positions on karma, or the various positions on why things happen. Not so much how things happen, but why things happen. And the different positions that were held by different groups during the historical Buddha's time. And then eventually we're going to look at the Buddha's own articulation of what he understood karma to mean. And then from there, even from there, the kind of further development within the Buddhist tradition, the further developments of notion of karma within the Buddhist tradition, and to some degree, how this kind of core idea of karma as represented in the early teachings of the Buddha interacted with certain local cultures and picked up some cultural baggage. I don't mean to say that these cultural baggage is necessarily wrong or has tarnished or has made impure. the original teachings of the Buddha, although that is a position that some people would hold and legitimate for whatever reasons that they're doing. I don't take that as my kind of first position in terms of like, here's the original teachings and then there's all this other stuff that has obscured or that has kind of tarnished the original purity. Personally, I see ideas and beliefs as kind of developing and interacting. So you have timeless, if you want to call it, you have timeless truths, but these timeless truths always come through to us within historical context. Yeah. Now, which is not to say that it cannot be perverted when it comes through historical moments and context. And we might even have time to go look at some ways in which karma has been understood that I would find myself, and I will make that clear, and you can decide if it's sort of a perversion of the original kind of intent of the Buddha. But at other times, I think it's not so much a perversion or even a kind of move in a different direction, but rather just ways in which, you know, human beings have interacted with these ideas, with these, you know, timeless truths based on their particular historical and cultural circumstance. So generally, we will begin, you know, we'll take this kind of historical approach, but I'm not going to bore you with details of history. You know, there's not going to be quizzes, you know, like which century, what happened. So I don't want to trigger all those traumas associated with sitting in class, falling asleep, trying to stay awake, and, you know, history class is going on and on. And then, you know, it might trigger even like, you know, is this going to be in the test? Do I need to know this? Are there going to be unannounced quizzes? Now, before I start with the pre-Buddhist uses of the word karma, maybe, I don't know if you guys want to participate in this, do you have some examples of what you think are clearly kind of odd or perhaps funny ways in which the word karma is being used or have been used that you have seen? Yes.
Yeah, I've seen it used as far as retribution. So, you know, you do this, this is going to happen.
Right. So the notion of retribution, right? Karma is going to bite you.
Yeah.
There's probably a bumper sticker like that, you know. Karma is going to bite you.
Karma ran over my dogma.
Oh, yes. My karma ran over my dogma. That's definitely a bumper sticker. Yes.
The John Lennon song, Instant Karma is going to get you.
Instant Karma is going to get you.
I remember a friend of mine in high school, the bass player in his band didn't show up for their practice, and when he was telling me how annoying this guy was, and he was saying yesterday he just didn't come because he said he was just sensing bad karma. Like, so he
he was sensing.
It was like he was sensing some bad vibes.
Some bad vibes, right. Is he Californian or?
Yeah.
Other examples?
A reaction to an action.
A reaction to an action. Uh-huh.
And there's instant karma.
Oh, right. Just down on Lexington or... And now there's instant karma west even. They open up another one.
Hi, Grandma. It's me, Pete. Where have you been for the last 20...
And everybody remembers this? But just listen.
In your eyes all the way. If I listen to your lies, would you say I'm a man without
it's relevant. Here's where it's relevant. More. Yeah, karma, 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 chameleon. You come and go. Any other things you might remember about how karma is used?
Very flippantly.
Very flippantly.
Flippantly.
Flippantly. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Oh, bad karma. Good karma.
Uh-huh. Good, bad karma. Yes. So the Buddha, we know he taught about karma. Now, I don't know how many of you actually have heard of this. Maybe it's just kind of one of these academic insider truism that is repeated ad nauseum in academic circles, and kind of assuming that the rest of the world actually know what they're talking about. But there are, there is this idea that karma wasn't really something that the Buddha taught, and that he simply, at best, picked up that idea since it was a common idea. That the real teachings of the Buddha is not really about karma. That's like Buddhism for dummies. Let's get to the real stuff. Right? And when we get to the real stuff, usually it's things like non-self, selflessness, emptiness, oneness with everything, and so on and so forth. That's what the Buddha really taught. As for this karma thing, it's just a remnant that the Buddha was in some ways still sort of a victim of his times, and so he simply picked that up. Or perhaps if they were more charitable, some might even say, oh, he just simply used the vocabulary and the idea that his audience understood, but the subtext is he didn't really mean it. Yeah, he didn't really mean it. And then there are those even within the Buddhist fold, or people who think of themselves as within the Buddhist fold, that might be really excited, really kind of like the idea that ultimately there is no karma. Like on the ultimate level, good karma, bad karma, it's all irrelevant. So in this group, it's not so much that they say the Buddha was just a victim of his times, or the Buddha simply used what his cultural context required him to use. In this third position, it's saying, actually, you get to a certain point where karma doesn't matter at all. Now, of course, people who really like that idea don't just like it because the Buddha said so. Right? They secretly perhaps like it because they think that they are quite close to also being karma being irrelevant to them. And that in some ways is sort of understandable, especially if all they can see about karma is along the lines of retribution. And that they have rejected that idea. Principally, people who come from a theistic background, which is practically everyone in this room. I don't even mean that, you know, at some point you convert it to the other way. But just culturally, coming from a theistic background, karma has just become a substitute for the idea of divine reward or divine retribution. As I was sharing with some of you last couple of days, I said, when I was coming in on Thursday for Open Sangha night, I saw this sign, a bumper sticker, actually, in West Asheville, that had a quote. And this was a quote, apparently, from Karma. So Karma is now talking. And the quote is, I saw that. Right? I saw that. So very clearly, right, that bumper sticker has simply replaced what? God with karma. Right? So it's the idea of God.
Or the universe.
Yes,
or the FBI.
Or the FBI. No, we don't believe in the FBI anymore, remember? It's the New World Order. FBI, CIA, what do they know? Karma is just this new word for God. Yeah, the word universe, that's another kind of interesting one, right? I mean, we're secretly all still in love with God, but we don't like that word, so we substitute it with universe, you know. Thank the universe for da 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 da. It's like... And when I was teaching at the in the university context, one of the things that I had to suffer through is to sit through these well-meaning kind of all-campus interfaith prayer, not prayer, you know, where someone is asked to lead a prayer, but again, well-meaning, you know, they don't want to offend anyone. So it goes with, you know, oh, living force of the universe, blah, blah, blah. I'm like, I don't know if the living force of the universe cares what you have to say to it. Either pray or not pray. Pray in the name of Jesus Christ. That's fine. I know where you're coming from. Anyway, side rant. Come back to karma. But actually, joking aside, in fact, we have a lot of baggage when we come into, you know, looking at some other idea, some other kind of system of thought, because words and ideas can be so similar, but there are important differences. And sometimes I find that people struggle with certain Buddhist teachings. They are fundamentally still struggling with the baggage that you have come in with. And not actually struggling with the ideas that are within this tradition. Now, of course, that's natural. So I'm not saying, oh, too bad, you're still doing that. But rather, as I often say, in some ways, when you're learning something new, and perhaps even adopting eventually something new, a new way of life, a new way of thinking about things, we all come with a certain set of questions formulated in certain ways, and we come looking for answers to those questions. And if we find those answers, then we say, ah, I think I like this particular way, this particular tradition, this particular worldview, this particular form of spirituality, this particular vantage point. And yeah, that's good. But I feel that we're not really undergoing change in a significant way until we begin to modify our questions. So it's not so much finding answers, or at least in the finding of the answers, it should lead us to ask questions differently. Because a lot of times, the questions that we're asking, the way in which they are formulated, has already determined, to some degree, what the answer is going to be. Sort of like if you're looking for a particular type of creature in the forest, and all you're looking for is that particular type of creature, that's all you're going to find or not find. But perhaps what you really need is something else. Yeah, so as much as this might provide you some answers to questions, hopefully engaging with this material on karma would also help us kind of modify and rethink the way we ask our questions. There's many occasions in the life of the Buddha where people would come to him and ask questions and he would be silent. And then these questioners would get frustrated and leave. And then his attendant will even be puzzled, like, why didn't you answer? Because the Buddha is not known for not answering questions all the time. In fact, most of the time, he would answer. But there are also enough times recorded where he simply did not answer. And there he says, those questions weren't asked in the right way. So that either way that I answer them, in the affirmative or in the negative, it will communicate the wrong message. So I can't answer those questions. Then the disciple, the attendant will say, well then, how should it be asked? And he would explain, you know. And then there are some cases where those individuals didn't go away, and he actually said to them, like, you know, the way you asked that question, let's revisit that before I answer one way or another. Let's just look at this first. So again, hopefully, in the course of, you know, this short course, it might, you know, get you to kind of look at your questions on this subject differently. So the word karma, in the handout that we have passed around, you will see that this word is also spelled somewhat slightly differently as not just K-A-R-M-A, but also K-A-M-M-A. It's a variant dialect called Pali. It's a canonical language. There are two Indic canonical languages for Buddhist scriptures. One is Pali and one is Sanskrit. And even Sanskrit, the Sanskrit that Buddhists use, has been called a kind of Buddhist hybrid Sanskrit, which is somewhat different from like the Hindu scholarly Sanskrit. And there's a hybrid Buddhist Sanskrit. Anyway, so in the Pali pronunciation is kamma, and then in Sanskrit is karma. So sometimes in these quotes, you're going to find that it's spelled as K-A-M-M-A, just so you know. So karma, but I'm going to just use the pronunciation karma because that's, you know, what most people know it as. So the word karma precedes the historical Buddha, of course. And in fact, it is found in the probably the world's most ancient scripture that is still in use to this day, which is the text known as the Veda. The Veda is the core text of all Hindu traditions. They are the authoritative and core texts of all Hindu traditions because by definition, you are Hindu if you accept the authority of the Veda, you accept the holy or sacred or special status of the Veda. The Veda, now, I say accept, I didn't say read or study or anything like that, because most contemporary forms of Hinduism don't actually give much attention to the Veda, but it needs to kind of give accept the central authority of the Veda. So in India, in fact, all the religious traditions are organized into either orthodox, meaning Vedic, or non-orthodox, meaning non-Vedic. So religious traditions like Buddhism is non-Vedic. Religious traditions like Jainism is non-Vedic, non-orthodox, or heterodox. And that which is orthodox is those who accept the authority of the Veda. So in the Veda, we find this word karma. But if you look at the Veda, karma primarily referred to... So karma itself, the word simply means action. Action. The plain meaning of the word karma is action. But if you look at the Veda, it does not refer to any and all types of action. It refers to ritually prescribed actions. Ritual actions. So not ordinary, mundane actions. Like brushing your teeth. That is not karma. Right? Karma is not used in that way in the Veda. In the Veda, when the karma is used, it is used to refer to ritually prescribed actions. So the way in which you ritually clean yourself, that is a karma. The way in which you make offerings to the gods, that is karma. The way in which you sustain your departed ancestors with offerings of food placed into the river. That is karma. The way in which you marry someone, that is karma. Yes?
So it seems to me that there's a separation between the sacred and the mundane. So would that mean what you do every day kind of is trivial? Or
it's not trivial. Okay. It's just not, the word karma is not used.
Okay.
Yeah, the word karma is not used to refer to ordinary activities. Eating, no. Now, what you don't eat, that's karma. Yeah, there are prescribed things that, you know, depending on what caste you are from, what point in your life you are from, certain types of food is, you know, pure to eat, certain types of food is not pure to eat, certain types of people is pure to eat with, certain types of people are not pure to eat with, so on and so forth. All those are karma. So karma are ritually prescribed actions. And that's really how the Veda uses the word karma. And so there it will say, karma is that which maintains the universe. Because it's through proper performance of ritually prescribed actions at the right time by the right people in the right season that the universe is maintained. Because order is maintained. Because ritual is also a means of ordering society. Of course, there is a kind of mythic religious idea of ordering the universe. But socially, ritual is also a means to order society. Yeah? And so that's how the word karma is used in these, in the earliest use of the word karma. Now, of course, it doesn't take long, yeah, before statements in the Veda like karma is that which maintains the world. Right? It doesn't take long, or maybe it took long, depending on your perspective of how long is long, a few hundred years, a century, 2 centuries, a millennium. But eventually, meaning this we do know, by 6th century BC, starting from 8th, I would say, 8th century on, you begin to see signs of people taking that statement. Karma is that which maintains the world to mean more than just ritually prescribed actions. Now, it shows that people were beginning to think that in fact, all actions, that it is actions, including brushing teeth, putting your clothes on, could be part of what maintains the cosmos. And so many different ideas began to percolate in that period, starting from the 8th century BC in India. And in these textbooks on, you know, history of religion in India, that period of time is often called Upanishad, the Upanishadic period. Prior to that, they call it Vedic period. Of course, no one who lived in those periods go, oh, we're living in the Vedic period. Right? This is just, you know, historians now kind of looking back, because why it's named after bodies of spiritual religious texts in which the basic ideas of those texts were kind of like the dominant ideas of the time. So it was during that time that we see the rise of these other types of spiritual texts that began to speculate on the poetry found in the Veda. See, the Veda consists of the core portions of the Veda are these poetries or songs that were seemingly used for the performance of religious rituals. During a fire sacrifice, you recite this verse or this verse. And for this ritual, you recite this verse or that verse. So when you come to the Upanishadic period, people begin to look at those prayers and hymns and began to reflect deeply on underneath this obvious layer, which seems to be praising the gods, the different gods, the different powers, the different goddesses. Is there something deeper going on? And that's when you see the rise of these texts that are eventually identified or that refer to themselves as the Upanishads. And these are many different Upanishads. In fact, in Hinduism today, they say that there is 108 Upanishads. Exactly what's in that list, depending on who you talk to, different names are given in that list. But in these Upanishads, we can say that they begin to speculate on the significance of what is being said in these hymns. And one of the speculations or meditations on these texts is focused on the issue of karma. And that is when, in fact, people thought, wait, karma must also mean beyond ritually prescribed actions. It must also mean actions in the context of social interactions. That's where it first went. Then among others, it went in even further to include all actions. Yeah, all actions. This period of time also coincided with the rise of another very important and powerful idea, which is the idea that this world that in the earlier period is kind of accepted as fundamentally an unqualified good, if not fragile, right? So in the Vedic period, life is good. There's a bumper sticker for that. Right? That's a very Vedic. Life is good. The world is good. But it's fragile. The forces of disorder or chaos, vritta, is constantly threatening ritta, which means order. So to control, to hold back this order from disrupting this fundamentally good life, world, universe, everyone needs to play their part and perform their karma. Now, in the Upanishads, perform your karma doesn't just mean lighting candles, burning incense, pouring ghee into sacred fires. At least among some, it meant all actions. But then, what becomes very clear in the Upanishadic period is a big question mark being raised on, wait, are we sure that this world is fundamentally a good place? Should we, in fact, put so much effort in gluing this back together? If Humpty Dumpty keeps falling, should we constantly be afraid that he's going to fall? And then he falls, and then we try to put him back together, And then he threatens to fall again, and so on and so forth. So then that is when this word, which maybe you're familiar with, called samsara, samsara, pronounced sang, the M, samsara, the notion of samsara, emerged. Before the French made it a fragrance. It's actually kind of weird, right? It's like, I don't know, Indians making a perfume and calling it poo. Would you like some poo on you? It's what samsara essentially means, it's like it sucks. Right? This world as we know it, it sucks. It's not worth it. But the problem with this thing that is not worth it is not that you can just get rid of it, because it keeps coming back. That in fact, the problem is not that this is not going to continue. The problem is that this is going to continue. And this continuance only entails stress, suffering, and a pointless recycling that goes on and on and on and on and on. This came around 8th century BC. Definitely when the historical Buddha came around, like 6th century, this idea was a common one. Of course, he had a certain understanding about the nature of this world, which he also called samsara. And of course, we're going to look at that. How did he think about samsara? So words like karma and samsara were common during the Buddha's time. In some cases, his ideas about samsara and karma definitely resonated with the broader understanding. But in many important ways, he also took a different understanding. By this time in the Upanishadic period, karma meant all actions, generally speaking. Then among some people, not all, among some people in India during that time, they understood karma as something that involves more than one lifetime. Now, in the Vedic period, we don't have explicit references to the idea of multiple lifetimes. We can't quite say that people didn't believe in multiple lifetimes the way that, majority of Hindus believe today and majority of Buddhists believe today. But there's no explicit discussion or references to multiple lifetimes in the Veda. If you want to construct an idea of like what did people possibly believe in, then it's fair to say they didn't necessarily believe in just this lifetime, but more accurately they believe that there's this lifetime, and then when we die, we all go to the land of the ancestors. But going to the land of the ancestors and continuing on in the land of the ancestors wasn't guaranteed and a given. That you will only remain in the land of the ancestors, which has happy connotations, get to hang out with all your family forever. So positive connotation, but It's only guaranteed if you have what?
Good karma.
Well, more practically.
Performed your ritual action.
Good action.
Well, yes, but you need to have what?
Family
that survives you, that will continue. Because they maintain you on that side. Not only should they not forget to feed Skip, they should not forget to feed you over there. So pets, family, ancestors.
Suppose they forget.
What?
Suppose they forget.
If they forget, then you get to haunt them. And if your hauntings, you get to haunt them. If your hauntings are powerful enough to make them remember, then things will be fine. But if your hauntings are not powerful enough, eventually you will die over there. And that's like a second death.
How is that the playing field the same for all caste systems? Did the caste systems, the playing field of
yeah.
all what you're mm-hmm. mapping this out was mm-hmm. for all caste systems?
Mm-hmm.
Levels or whatever.
Yeah, so everybody needs to make sure that they perform the right karmas. And not only that, by example, living by that example, that their next generation see them performing the karmas. Karmas to be performed towards the gods, karmas to be performed towards the ancestors, karmas to be performed towards society. So they talk about the debts and the obligations that each person has. You have obligations to the larger society. You have obligations to the gods. You have obligations to the ancestors. Right? And you perform them accordingly. Because that serves as the model for the next generation that will continue that. Again, kind of Vedic period. In the Upanishadic period, it's not as if everybody switched over. You know? That is still the mainstream idea. But then there are those who begin to question, like, is this recycling what we want? Because in the Upanishads, they kind of take this idea further and say, okay, so if starving grandpa eventually dies, then what happens? And that is when, well, they come back. In fact, in one of the Upanishads, it talks about a kind of a rather interesting naturalistic of coming back. It says that when the ancestor that is bad luck enough to have horrible descendants, that, you know, either horrible by not having further descendants, right? Not having people continue the line, or forgot about them. So when those die, it says that they turn into vapors that rise up into the sky, that turn then into clouds, which comes down as water, which then becomes leaves, which is eaten by cattle, which then comes into our system when we eat cattle, and then is reborn as a human being. Yeah. So a very early kind of idea of how you cycle back. Yeah. And that, you know, yeah, that somehow the essence, right, gets passed through, which then comes together and you're born again. Now, eventually, the quote-unquote mature understanding or theory comes about, which is the one that we are familiar with, the idea that in multiple lifetimes you can be reborn, yeah, and less kind of mechanistic, less like organically based, right? This notion of coming back, the essence is born immediately when they're conceived, and so on and so forth. So then karma during this period was considered as a corporate matter, not an individual matter, which is a family-based notion of karma. So that this generation inherits the karma of previous generations. The McCoys and the Hatfields. So that each generation is heir to the karma of previous generation in one direction, and karma towards the ancestor as well, so that all that is maintained. So that was a prevalent idea during Buddha's own time, that when people talked about karma, they talked about it as a family matter, that our family has this and this and this kind of karma. And to be born in this family means I share with them this karma. And their notions of caste was reinforced very strongly. That you are born into a privileged class or caste is because you share with your family that karma. And if you took care of your family well and perform, right, your class-based karma, then you can improve your karma. Right? So those were some of the kind of general mainstream ideas of karma by the time the Buddha was born into his world. Any questions, comments, any thoughts about any resemblances of these ideas? So that's the other thing I want us to do. Yeah? Don't take this as just talking about things that happened a long time ago. Like, what variation of these beliefs actually exist in our own culture? And to what degree?
This is godliness.
Sorry?
Cleanliness is godliness.
Same wall.
Heard that before.
Yeah, how you're relating to.
In the vague period, or.
How? In what way clean?
When you said they started using, thinking of karma as daily routines, brushing their teeth.
Ah, okay. In that sense, yes. Cleanliness, more so the notion of ritual cleanliness, which is then connected with notions of, okay, if we go from ritual cleanliness, where can we go from there? What implications in a system that emphasizes ritual cleanliness? Yes?
Health.
Sure, it can go in that direction. Where else can it go?
If you don't have cleanliness, bad things would happen.
Okay, so health is one context, but...
Thoughts and mind.
What?
Mind and thoughts.
The mind and thoughts, okay, where else?
That there are people who are unclean.
Ah, there are people that are unclean.
And untouchable.
Yeah, so ritual cleanliness, even health cleanliness, right? It's never quite separate from class concerns. So think about our own society. We might not have ritual cleanliness as a category, as an idea, or as you know, verbalized, but it's there, right? When we think about class, we think about dirt. And dirt is not just physical dirt. We think of it as spiritual dirt. Just calling attention to like the potential kind of dangers that comes with the idea of purity and pollution. I'm not ready to throw that out and say therefore it's bad, but we're moving into this area where likewise the notion of karma has gone in those directions. So one time I just want to give you this kind of an anecdote. One time I was at the Buddhist center. We were studying kind of philosophy, and by talking about kind of ancient Buddhist positions that they were debating each other and things like that. And at one point, the teacher said to us, he said, this whole activity is not really beneficial if you relate to these kind of different positions and different debates as merely historical details. He said, that's not the most kind of productive way of engaging this material. And so, you know, people say, well, so how should we engage this material? And he said, this should be held up as a mirror for us to reflect on. Where might this debate be relevant in our context today? Yeah, so hopefully, again, as we kind of survey kind of pre-Buddhist ideas, let's not just think, oh, these are what people believe, you know, 3,000 years ago, far, far away in India.
I think it happens every day. I think a lot of people have all kinds of ideas.
Yes.
If I wear this color, the team will win.
Mm-hmm.
Or... you know, if you say something, you jinx it, so you don't say things.
All right. So that's related more to kind of, what, magic thought?
Superstition.
Right? Magic thinking, right? Sure. But here it has a lot to do with kind of like notions of?
Them and us.
Them and us.
Reward for good behavior?
Moral values that is tied to class, that is tied to distinctions, that is tied to deserve or don't deserve.
Sounding really familiar.
Yeah.
I mean. And I just heard on NPR somebody say that two of the preachers that are going to be at the inaugural at the inauguration for President-elect Trump believe this kind of thing where he was picked because God wanted it. It's a sort of
ordained. The prosperity gospel. Mm-hmm. That's the bottom line.
Okay.
He didn't mean it.
Well, one of them has been investigated and arrested for fraud before. I mean, they're crooks, basically.
There is a prosperity gospel. It's taught in churches. I mean, it's a big deal in some churches.
So this caste system may be to keep it going. It was in the sense of if you're in the caste, you must be doing the right thing. You're good and clean.
Yeah. And okay, let's zoom out a little. I submit that what's happening now is just bringing certain things in focus, things that has always been there. Many of us like to believe that it's no more there. But there are many others who have always experienced life in America in this way.
The good old days were not.
Yeah. And whether it's 8 years ago, 4 years ago, or 80 years ago, there's a lot more work to be done. So, as much as, you know, I think many of us have a lot of fear about what will happen in the next 4 years, I think we miss the bigger picture if we think that it started with a certain person being elected. Certainly doesn't help a certain person is being elected. But as we will find out from the lessons to learn from karma, maybe it can be made helpful. That's Buddha's teaching on karma. Yes, certain conditions are ripening that is negative. But that's not the end of what is to be learned from karma. Because karma is also about what to do now. The way the Buddha puts it. Yeah. So let's take a short break, stretch, and then we'll come back and look at the positions that the Buddha himself directly addressed and disagreed with. So that would be the
Thank you for listening to the Urban Dharma NC podcast. If you enjoyed this episode, we hope you'll consider supporting our mission to foster a deeper understanding of the teachings of the Buddha, to build meaningful community, and to integrate contemplative teachings into everyday life. We invite you to make a donation online at udharmanc.com. Thank you. May all beings benefit.